This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents The Dead Drink First. Written by Dale Maharidge. Produced by Emily Martinez. Narrated by Dale Maharidge. Please note, this story features explicit language and references to domestic abuse, violence, and war that may be upsetting to some listeners. Discretion is advised. If you or someone you know is a veteran struggling with PTSD, please visit www.ptsd.va.gov. Prologue.
If you met my dad, Steve, you'd never know he was a Marine in World War II. You'd never know he survived three battles against Japan, or that he had multiple severe blast concussions. He kept his Purple Heart stuffed in a drawer. He didn't go to parades, and he didn't go to those dingy beer joints and hang out with vets sharing war stories. When I asked him about the war, this hard look would come over his face, and he just stared off into the distance and said nothing. He believed in forgetting. But growing up, I could see the war was still part of my dad's life, no matter how much he tried to forget. And it shaped my life as well, in ways I'm still coping with today. I remember standing with him in our front yard when I was 7 years old. He's throwing fallen green apples into the woods across the road to show me how he tossed grenades during the war. You pull the pin, wait 10 seconds, and throw. I imagine Japanese soldiers in the trees. He has a scar on his back that looks like he was struck by lightning. He told me it was from a Japanese grenade. Dad almost never talked about the war. But when he did, he always said, "There are no heroes. You just survive. You move on."
No, you did your service. You came home. Back then, they didn't call them heroes. You went back to your life. But, you know, you left when you're 18. You're 24 now. You come back or whatever. You don't have a life. Only life you know is fighting the Japs or the Germans.
He was drunk for 4 years when he came back, on his ass. In a way, can you blame him?
No, I would be.
You know, our mother saved him.
Oh, well, we did too.
Yeah. We made him normal.
Right. At least gave him a sense of normalcy.
Me and my brother Daryl knew there was nothing normal about how we grew up. We spent our lives trying to make sense of our father's demons. Dad had a blue-collar day job as a steel worker. Then he'd come home, take a nap, and after dinner, he'd go work in our basement. He had a mini factory down there full of a dozen massive machines for sharpening industrial steel tools. He called it D&D Tool Company, as in Dale and Daryl. His hope was that me and my brother would take it over. It was going to be his legacy to us, but we weren't interested. The machines drew so much power that sometimes the lights would dim, and the grinding wheels sometimes exploded like shrapnel. They put holes in the ceiling. It was a weird way to grow up. Really weird. Gray steel dust was everywhere. It drove my mom crazy. After school, I had to clean up around the machines. Up in the gas meter, there was a black and white photograph from the war. I always took it down and wiped it off. My dad's standing with some guy. They're both smiling. The guy has his left arm around my father. Cone-shaped military tents and palm trees are in the background. They seem happy, even though they were at war. I always wondered, who was that guy? Dad didn't have any friends. When I was 12, Dad taught me how to grind and he paid me about $3 an hour. That was a lot of money back then. It was our way of connecting. As we worked, I saw him staring at the photo through the spray of orange sparks. I asked him about it once. He told me it was from Guadalcanal, an island in the Pacific. But I could see in his face that he didn't want to talk about it. So my instinct was to never bring it up again. I was afraid to bring it up. Now, it's pretty much my job to ask hard questions. I've been a journalist for decades. I've covered wars, national security, and poverty in America. In all my years as a reporter, one thing I've learned? We have a short-term memory. My friend Studs Terkel once told me that for most Americans, there is no past. He wrote the 1985 Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Good War.
One of my themes is in this book is forgetfulness. You see, we're suffering right now from what I call a national Alzheimer's disease. There is no past.
Stutz told me this over lunch at a noisy Chicago restaurant back in 1988. That's bleak coming from an oral historian, but Stutz wanted people to remember the brutality of World War II. But his book solidified the good war narrative in American culture, this black and white idea of good versus evil, and we were the heroes. The irony of his title was lost on us. My dad's war was not a good one. Over time, history gets fuzzy and takes on a new shape. We forget the unfortunate details, and there were a lot of them. I'm a professor at Columbia University, so I asked some students on campus about it. What do you know about World War II?
What do I know about World War II? I guess the general history that most people know, Hitler and all that stuff.
I'm not a historian, but I know the dates. I know countries that participated.
Tell us the dates and the countries that participated.
So it started in 1942, it went on to 1945, and I know that it was between the Brits, the Americans, I think against the French and...
Russia? No? Russia was an allied power.
Right.
There we go.
Don't know which side the Germans were on, but the Germans were involved as well.
What about Japan?
What about Japan?
Japan was on the other side.
I read Flags of Our Father as summer reading, I think, in either college or high school, which kind of dealt a little bit with Japan's side of things.
Do you remember any major battles of World War II?
I don't think I could name any, no.
Besides the atomic bomb, I don't think I could name specific battles.
They can name the Holocaust, Nazis, Pearl Harbor, and the atom bombs dropped on Japan, but not much else. For anyone who played hooky in 7th grade history, World War II was fought from 1939, when Hitler invaded Poland, to 1945. It involved more than 30 countries, and it was the deadliest war in history. How many people total in all theaters of battle died in World War II, do you think?
Over 4 million.
35 million people?
80 million.
80 million.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. Yeah, that was way off.
Wow.
Stunning. That's also terrifying. I feel like the general public should probably know that.
We forget that 80 million people died. It's a number that's hard to fathom. That's roughly one quarter of the American population today. I guess the world's moved on. But for me and my brother Daryl and other kids from the 1960s, forgetting wasn't an option. We lived with the aftermath of the war, with our father's nightmares and flashbacks, with their drinking and unpredictable violence. Dad had a scary temper. He could snap, and then he became a screaming monster. It was like I had two fathers, one I hated and one I loved. I knew he was trying. He succeeded a lot of times, and he failed a lot of times. A big part of him was never accessible. There was a door he kept tightly shut, a door that we could never open. It led back to the war. Back to the moment the man in the picture was killed. Dad took that secret to his grave. It was a mystery that haunted me my entire life. I spent almost 20 years searching for that man, trying to open that door my father kept closed, to walk in and learn why he was so tortured for so long. I wrote a book about it, and I learned that my father's buddy died during the Battle of Okinawa in 1945. His body was lost, and my father blamed himself. On August 21st, 2018, in a monsoon-like rainstorm, the man was buried near Sergeant Steve Maharidge at Arlington National Cemetery, 73 years after he was killed. This is the story of how I found the man in the picture and brought him home.
Chapter 1. The Man in the Picture.
Still February 17th or thereabouts, and there's Dale.
That's my dad, Steve Maharich.
Well, wouldn't it be something if you caught one now, huh?
We're fishing at a local river in 1989.
He's casting in this rough water here.
When I think of my dad, I think of his hands. They always had open wounds from grinding steel on the machines. They were the hands of a working man.
Well, I focus in. Okay, go ahead.
I'm using a rooster tail. This is a good trout lure, supposedly. I don't know if it's a good steelhead lure. We're trying to fish for steelhead today.
When my parents got married in 1950, they were a handsome couple. In old pictures, Dad often wore a suit and tie and a fedora. He had deep Russian immigrant roots on the tough south side of Cleveland. With his dark hair slicked back, he looked like a Southside gangster, which he kind of was. My mother Joan was thin, with long flowing hair. She was snarky and smart, with dreams of going to beauty school to become a hairdresser. But after she married, she became a full-time mom. And later, she drove a manual school bus, no small feat in those brutal Cleveland winters. They were a typical couple for that neighborhood, which has changed a lot since then. Here's me and my Uncle Bobby, my mom's little brother, outside an old shot and beer joint that's somehow still standing. We can start by saying, where do we just drink?
Hutz's Cafe on Starkweather Avenue and West 10th Street, about a block up from my great-grandmother's house, a block and a half up from your grandparents' house.
Where my father grew up?
On Starkweather Avenue, absolutely. The old neighborhood, the south side. Before it became the Tremont Historic District.
Yes. We just passed some hipsters, so it's different than when you were a kid here.
Quite different. Much cleaner. The steel mills aren't belching out all the goo and Harshaw Chemical and Glidden Paint and the city incinerator.
Standard Oil,
all, you know, doing all their things. Yeah, the neighborhood was really dirty. And the people who lived in the houses really, they didn't have much money. This was a really blue-collar neighborhood.
I went back with Uncle Bobby to revisit demons from my childhood. He knew things about my family that I needed to talk about. He was 6 when he first met my father. Dad had come home from World War II a few years earlier.
Of course, I had toy soldiers, and I would do little war games on the table, and Steve would play war games with me. And I had a tank, and I was advancing on his troops. He said, "Your tank can't go any farther." And I said, "Well, why?" He said, "Well, we just shot the treads off your tank." I said, "You can't do that." He says, "Yeah, you can." And I figured, well, geez, he was in the war. He must know.
After the war, Dad was drunk for nearly 4 years, and he took part in a gambling racket. He had a lot of trauma, which he kept hidden.
War was not something that ever came up very much. I asked him once, "Did you ever kill anybody in the war?" And he said, "Yeah, maybe." They were on Okinawa, and they were standing guard duty. And there was a shadow, and they shouted to the shadow, "Identify yourself." The person said nothing, just kept walking. And they shot. And it turns out it was an old woman who probably didn't understand what they were saying. He didn't elaborate on the story. He said that's just the way it was.
That's what you call doing a polka there. Yeah. Hey, Frank, let's do the polka.
He was trying hard to be a good dad. And he was, most of the time. Every Friday, he took us to Barron's, a family-style steak joint in Cleveland. We'd go on summer vacations to Florida, and there were weekend camping trips. But there was another side, a darker side.
I didn't see what happened. Joan showed up at our door. He had hit her across the face with a lead pipe. And we had no car, so they walked to City Hospital, which was 15, 16 blocks away. And Steve showed up at the apartment, and it must have been springtime. I had given my mother a pot with, I think, a hyacinth planted in it. And Steve showed up down below, and there was a lot of shouting, and they were arguing. And my mother picked that pot up, and she had a pretty good throwing arm. And she pitched it at Steve, and he had to duck. It was pretty violent.
That happened before I was born. But later, when I was 4 or 5 and we lived next door to my grandparents, something else happened.
Apparently Steve had come home. He was drunk. He chased her up into the bathroom, kicked her into the corner, and kept kicking and kicking, and she was down. How she got out of the house, I don't know. She came running over to our house, frantic, pounding on the door. My mother and father both went over there. Steve was in the house, and he locked the door on him. And my mother took one of the chairs that was on the front porch and threw it against the picture window. I don't think it broke the window, but I had never seen her that enraged. I was in high school at the time, and I called the North Rutland police. I wanted to see him in jail. I was really furious. I remember Joan sat in the corner, and she was battered. She was bruised. We sat in the living room. We didn't say anything. I felt horrible.
Was she bleeding?
No, not that I remember.
Because there was a time that my father threw her down the stairs, and there was a splotch of blood. We had that black and white wool carpet, and it just haunted my childhood.
Yeah.
I don't remember seeing my mother tumble down the stairs, but for decades I had nightmares about that pool of her blood on the carpet. My mom and us kids slept in my grandparents' attic for a few days after that. I felt helpless. When I got older, Mom told me she threatened to take us kids and leave if he ever hit her again, and he didn't.
But they fought. Those scared the shit out of me.
They fought constantly. My brother Daryl and I recently talked about this for the first time ever. I'm 62, he's 57. I remember in sixth grade, we went to the Catholic grade school, St. Albert the Great. Remember the girls sat on one side and the boys on the other?
Oh, yeah.
And Father Winter sat at the front and he was talking about premarital sex, how it's bad.
How old were you?
This is sixth grade. And I raised my hand and I said, but how can sex be premarital if you never get married? And I got whacked by the nun. And I thought I was being a smartass. But I wasn't being a smartass. I always thought, why the fuck would you want to get married if you want to live like our parents? That's like, that's hell. And so the woman I'm seeing now who doesn't understand why I've never been married, you know?
Well, I've been twice and I suck at it.
But I just never wanted to be that.
Dad's dark side was meant to be kept secret, a family secret. My mother, who died in 2009, would roll in her grave if she heard me talking about it. But there was no hiding it. I literally wore it on my face. You can see my terror in our family pictures. In baby photos, I'm always smiling. By the age of 10, I'm scowling. When Dad was angry, he'd yell, "Wait till you get in the service." He told me about a guy who did a bad job on his laundry. The drill sergeant made the guy chew the shit stains from his underwear. Someday I'd have to chew the shit stains from my underwear. I remember spilling a glass of water at the table. Dad suddenly screaming. Mom screaming back. When I got older, me screaming.
One time he punched you.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, I remember. I remember thinking, well, who would hit their own kid? You were arguing about something, probably about Vietnam or something, and you were going spouting off about something, and he hauled off and hit you.
Wow.
How can you not remember someone smacking
you? The blotting, man. I'm telling you, a lot of shit got blotted.
Daryl remembered a lot of things that I'd blocked out. He was always quiet and withdrawn. Our mother worried about that.
Did you call me Mr. Spock because I didn't show emotion? I blanked a lot.
Why?
Because I was terrified.
Tell about that. Why were you terrified?
Well, you know how I used to come home from work and he'd lay down in front of the fireplace, take a nap? When I was five-ish, I don't know. I don't even know if I was in school yet. I came running up the stairs yelling for Mama or somebody, and I woke him up just as he was drifting into La La Land, and he's raged with the eyes, you know, glaring. He says, "I could kill you." You know, every night I'd go to bed and I'd see this black shadow figure outside the door, and I always thought he was just waiting for me to fall asleep.
Oh, wow.
So why can't I sleep? You know?
You still have trouble sleeping?
Yeah, I take medication for it. I had a sleep study done in the early 2000s, and the technician said I jerked myself awake like 80 times every hour. I would twitch. Just enough to wake up.
We knew Dad had issues, but as kids, we didn't have a name for it. His problems became our problems.
Did you ever associate his anger with the war in any sense when you were a kid?
What war? I didn't know what war was.
Right.
I mean, the five-year-old will never get it.
No. You're 5 years old.
Well, we all are. What do we remember from 5 years old? Hopefully most of us have happy, loving memories. Some of us don't.
Yeah. We thought we were alone. At least for me. I don't know if I'm speaking for you. That's how I felt.
Yeah. Alone on an island. Everybody else was normal. We weren't.
Right. My reaction was to run and hide. If things got crazy in the house, I just got the fuck out of there. I would hike miles. The cat would follow me.
Yeah.
She'd follow me the whole way. She liked going on walks. So I'd take the cat and go on walks. Cat walks. And I was happy in the woods. I mean, it was quiet. The only noise was the creaks under the snow and just miles of nothing. A lot of woods around the house. And that was my cathedral.
I'm turning left onto Ridge Road, which is our road. Okay, I'm coming up on it. I really don't want to be coming here. I really feel this is the last time I'll be coming home. There's the shop. Nothing looks the same.
You're punctual, I'll give you that.
Oh, Glenn. Man, I thought it was going to be really early. Hey, man.
While I was in Cleveland, I stopped by to see Glenn Heller, who bought my dad's old grinding business in 1985.
God, I clicked on that picture you sent me to LinkedIn. I go, oh my God, it's Steve.
You're the second person. Yesterday.
Especially you had the long hair. Put a hat
on the guy. The company was now in a brick building behind the house. It's for sale, but Glenn can't find a buyer. It was strange thinking that what my dad had done his whole life had no value.
Is this a job here?
Yeah. Yeah, these are good. I'm supposed to get these out of Muppet Building. I got the stuff down.
He was about to dump the machines for scrap in just a few weeks. The exact same machines as when I was a kid. The Cincinnati No. 2, the LeBlanc, the Covell. Glenn's shop smelled like steel dust, like a cast iron pan left on a burner too long. Marcel Proust had his Madeleines. I have burnt steel. If this were a film, this would be the flashback scene, in black and white. I can almost see my father. Suddenly, I'm 12 years old again, grinding tools with him. Dad's blasting 1940s big band classics on a small plastic radio. Once in a while, he'd bring up the war. One night, sparks flying. He tells me about the Battle of Guam. Dead Marines surround him. He stacks their bodies and the bodies of Japanese soldiers around his foxhole to protect himself from bullets and shrapnel. Marines are crying for their mothers. Dad starts screaming as he slams the cutting tool into the grinding wheel. Fuck you. You don't have no fucking mother. She's not here. Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up. Your mother isn't going to help you now. He's reliving the night of the battle. Another night. He's on pain medication after a drunk driver hit him. It makes him a whole lot more emotional. Dad stops grinding and looks over at the man in the picture. He mentions Okinawa. They blame me. I came in that night with his .45. They said I killed him, but I didn't kill him. It wasn't my fault. I just listen. As always, instinct tells me never to ask questions. Dad goes off his meds. He never discusses it again.
You ever remember him talking about that picture?
It used to be attached to this metal cabinet. And I remember one time I asked him, I said, he looks like you served in the Pacific. And he didn't say much. I got the impression he didn't want to talk about it. And I can tell he was uneasy, so I didn't push it, you know. And then he says, my sons were in a war. I said, I'd personally drive them to Canada so they wouldn't have to go through that. And that's pretty much all he said. And he told by the way he looked. You know your dad's faces, so you could tell when he did or didn't want to talk something. It was a sore spot. But yeah, he had that out every day.
I can see it right now.
He just stared at the picture when I asked him that before he responded, and then he just made that comment, you know. I know a lot of veterans keep it inside and don't say anything. I'm sure he's not going to talk to me about it. He barely knew me, you know.
I always wondered what my brother thought about the picture.
I don't know if I have a first memory. That guy was always in a picture on our wall. He just became part of the family. Like the vase on the table, it just blends in. It's part of the home.
Right. It was on the gas meter. Remember, you walk into that room, it was on the right.
Well, yeah, but it moved. He put it on the fuse box at one point.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. It was out.
Yeah, it was out in the main room.
Well, what did you think about it? We didn't talk about the picture as kids. I don't remember talking.
No, you just don't talk about it.
Clearly, it was an old snapshot. Square, maybe 3 inches by 3 inches, something like that. Pasted above the machine. And I, at first I thought, you know, that, well, that's a little bit odd. But then again, I thought, well, you know, obviously it was when Steve was in the military and this other guy obviously was in the military. I had no idea who it was. I figured, well, obviously they were friends. They were standing there. I think Steve had his arm around him or the other way around. I can't remember. And I said, what a nice thing to do. I had no idea that the guy was dead.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Joan. Happy birthday to you.
My parents retired in California, somewhere warm. By that age, my dad had really mellowed out, and they traveled a ton together. They went to Hawaii, Mexico, Las Vegas, and they went on cruises and road trips. Dad videotaped everything, though he focused on mundane stuff, like the weather and flowers in the garden.
They have some African daisies here. Some yellow daisies back
he took
there.
The picture with him and put it up in the That's garage. Dad was kind of like a working class Don Draper from that TV series Mad Men, minus the womanizing. Like Don Draper, my dad was a man with a secret from a war. That secret? What happened to the man in the picture? I always thought he might eventually open up about the war. A few years before he died, he sent away for his military records. When they came, he set them on the counter in front of me and said, "You won't get these when I'm gone." I didn't realize until it was too late that this was his way of saying it was okay to ask questions.
Maybe he was ready to talk. I don't know.
Well, he went so quick. I mean, he was doing the wallpaper a week before I got there. Then he was in bed and could barely get up.
He went down in flames. He told me at one point, he said, "If it wasn't for your mother, you'd have turned out like shit."
Dad got sick in the summer of 2000. His liver was riddled with cancer. He only lasted a few weeks after the diagnosis. I learned on his deathbed just how much he felt he'd failed as a dad. I told him he was wrong, and I counted the ways he'd been a great dad. I made a joke and got him to laugh. And then I said, "I'll see you later." And within 2 days, he was gone. The picture stayed up in the garage after Dad died. I went into his bedroom drawer and I found a small copy of it in a box. On the back was written H.W. Mulligan. That was about the only clue Dad left. He never even talked about it with my mother. She saw it almost every day when she took the trash out. Mom and I were really close. When I was a kid, I'd sit with her in the bathroom and we'd talk as she smoked cigarettes and got ready for bed. A year after Dad died, she got cancer. One day, I was making lunch for her when she was really sick, and she started wondering out loud what her life would have been like if she never met my father. Maybe she'd have gone on to beauty school, or maybe even college. I think she resented him for all those years of turmoil. She always protected me against my father's explosive temper. She'd get between us and she'd fight back. She was pretty strong herself. When Dad died, she said she lost her sparring partner. But as I made grilled cheese sandwiches, she threw her hands up and muttered, "Ah, you can't change the past." Mom never mentioned my father to me again. She died a year and a half later.
And that's Daddy in 1937. These are little pictures I blew up. That's Daddy on Guadalcanal in the jungle. He went back and wrote a lot of this in ballpoint pen probably a couple of years ago when he organized the pictures. The word grim was written in the back of this picture. It wasn't Daddy's writing. Daddy and Herman Mulligan now. Yeah. I should have asked him why he kept that nearby. He probably wouldn't have told me.
I say once he talked about it. He never talked
he
about it.
He probably wouldn't have told me.
But once he talked about it. And he's a real lanky looking guy.
I know he got killed.
Yeah, I think it was on Okinawa. He got killed.
I felt the same way. I wish we had discussed everything. The picture, the war, the yelling, the flashbacks, and the splotch of blood. Now in my 60s, I'm still seeking answers. I inherited the picture of my father in Mulligan. I always connected it with his rage. I had to know, what the hell happened? If I couldn't change the past, maybe I could understand it. So I began a quest to learn all I could about H.W. Mulligan. Among Dad's things, I found another clue. A silk Japanese flag signed by a bunch of guys from my father's Marine unit.
You what? I'm the son of Steve Maharaj. Do you remember Steve?
Maharaj?
Yeah, he was in L Company. And if it's you, you signed his flag.
Yeah?
Do you remember him?
Well, where are you from?
Well, I'm in New York right now. My father died, and I'm tracking down guys from his company for a kind of a crazy reason. There was a guy named Herman Walter Mulligan, who was my dad's friend, who was killed, and his body was never recovered. And I'm trying to track down what happened to Mr. Mulligan. Do you remember Herman Walter Mulligan?
Chapter 2, The Good War. Part 1, The Battle.
The number you dialed is not in service.
That doesn't sound good.
After I called all the men who signed my dad's Japanese flag, I later got a copy of what the military calls muster rolls. It's a roster of 400 guys who were in Love Company. I made thousands of calls, most ending in failure. You can't imagine how many Harrises and Robertsons there are. And that's how I found Joe in 2010. A lot of these recordings are pretty noisy because I started out years ago with a cassette tape recorder and then a very primitive digital one.
Do you have my name correctly there, L-A-N?
C-I-O-T-T-I. Is your middle name Emerico?
That was my first name at that time. That's so wonderful. Well, I don't use Emerico. I haven't used it since high school. With the Marine Corps, they kept it for a while. I use Joseph.
Emerico, Joe Lanciotti, is one of a handful of guys still alive from Love Company, or officially L Company, which was part of the 3rd Battalion, 22nd Marines, 6th Marine Division. I told Joe about my search for the man in the picture.
What was Mr. Mulligan's first name?
Herman.
Why are you interested in him?
Well, he was my dad's buddy. I grew up with a picture of him and Mulligan on the canal.
Okay, and your dad was...
Steve? Yes.
He's gone.
He died 10 years ago. He just started talking about the war near the end, like a lot of the guys. You know?
He didn't get to talk about it too much with you.
No. How old are you now?
In my 85th year. I was 19 on Okinawa.
Well, you were a young guy, too.
Yeah, we were all young. When we came out, we were very old.
Only 3% of the 11 million American veterans who served in World War II remain alive today. I was really lucky to have found guys like Joe. When I first started talking with them nearly 20 years ago, they were in their 70s and 80s. I crisscrossed the country to meet them. Kansas, Minnesota, Georgia, Washington, Florida. I went wherever I had to go. Most of them hadn't really talked about the war to anyone before, and they remembered every detail like it was yesterday. Joe was opinionated. He felt strongly about the so-called Good War. He wrote about it in his own book called The Timid Marine. We kept in touch for years. He was full of wisdom.
There are no good wars. No. I don't know where people get that idea. I think somebody in the media maybe think it's something clever to say. Who they should ask are the people in it, and not only the soldiers, but the civilians. Was Vietnam a good war? Huh? Cambodia, Vietnam, Okinawa. Whether you win or lose, it's a bad war.
For Tom Price, another member of Love Company, it seemed like a necessary war. He told me he was driving on December 7, 1941, when an announcement came over the car radio that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor.
Then, that was the good war. Everybody was mad. Boy, I mean, they bombed Pearl Harbor, killed our people over there. We're going to get them suckers, man. One night, I think a balloon got loose. It was floating over Long Beach, and boy, they start banging away at it. Shook the whole neighborhood.
And, actually, the Japanese did send balloons over.
Well, but that was one of ours that got loose soon. People were scared, too. We thought, God dang, man, they're here.
Tom is typical of the men who were in Love Company. Most came from working-class families struggling in the depths of the Great Depression. Tom's parents left their Missouri farm behind and headed west with the kids to find work in California.
You know, everybody rushed down to join.
Did you join?
No, I was drafted. But all my friends was in the service. I was dying to get in. But my mother said, I'm not signing. When you turn 18, I got no choice. But I'm not signing any paper before that, you know. Anyway, I turned 18. We went back to Missouri, and I dropped out of school because I knew I was going into service. While I was back there, I turned 18. I got my letter from Uncle Sam, you know, we want you.
My dad got his third notice. He decided I better go listen.
My dad was 18 when he dropped out of high school and was drafted into the Navy. Ridiculous as it sounds, he told me he didn't want to wear bell-bottom pants, the official Navy uniform, so he volunteered to join the Marines instead. I told Dad, maybe that wasn't so smart. He just shrugged. You couldn't be drafted into the Marines. You had to sign up. The reality is that they have the toughest job. They're the ones who land on beaches under fire. To prepare, they go through hell in basic training. Remember my father's shit stain story. During boot camp, Tom came down with the measles and had to be quarantined. When he came back, all of his friends were gone.
All the guys I was in boot camp with, they was gone, you know. Never saw them again. Anyway, while I was on mess duty there, big long tables, and they'd say, bread over here. So, man, like a football, I was throwing the bread, and this guy turned around. Oh, man. I know that face. I said, hey, yeah, I know you're Harold Stewart. Yep, I am. And he was a year ahead of me in junior high school. And to see somebody that you know, it's just like a drink of brandy on a cold day when it hits your stomach, you know, it just warms you all over.
Tom was later shipped across the Pacific Ocean to Guadalcanal, an island south of the equator. Love Company went there to train in 1944. My dad told me he liked shooting up bunches of coconuts in the palm trees with his Browning automatic rifle. It was here that the picture of my dad and Mulligan was taken in front of the tents where they lived. I have no idea who the photographer was. The guys weren't supposed to have cameras. Dad also had other pictures. In one, Mulligan sits regally in a chair. In another, he holds a human skull. He put a hat on it and a swastika is drawn on the forehead. They're always smiling and Mulligan is dressed super well. Somehow his tan uniform is unwrinkled and perfect. My dad looks sloppy. His shirt is open and his belly is showing.
He was always a neat-looking guy. That picture shows. Your dad's suntans look wrinkles, and Mulligan's look like they just come out of the goddamn cleaning shop or someplace. A good-looking kid.
Fenton Gabby Grainard is one of the few surviving guys from Love Company who remembered Mulligan. I wanted to know more, but everyone else who really knew him well was dead. What I heard from Gabby were like pieces of a 10,000-part puzzle.
And he had the prettiest legs you ever saw for a man. And the one old sergeant we had, he said, hell, I'd like to go to bed with him. He said, God, he's got the prettiest legs I ever saw.
In addition to having pretty legs, Mulligan was also a jokester, even during combat. One time he pulled a prank that almost got him shot by his buddies.
Dumb asshole, he found a Japanese uniform down there below the cable station at Sumé. He put the goddamn thing on and come walking back up, and he damn near got killed.
What the hell was he doing?
Gee, he was being smart.
Yeah, he was smart,
Japanese
right?
Uniform on, and we goddamn near shot him.
My dad and the others from Love Company were not like the soldiers you see in the movies, tough guys and heroes made from the same cookie-cutter mold. They were just teenagers. Like my dad, Joe was 18.
I consider myself a real rough guy, although I was just a kid here in Jersey. I was not a rough guy. It was the movies that made me think I was tough. When I got there, I realized how tough I was not.
In a picture of Joe as a young Marine, he had a wisp of hair on his lip, more hope than mustache. His tie is loose and he's got a drink in his hand. He looks like an artist. Guys called him the poet because he carried a book of poetry in his pack. As Love Company sailed north to fight in one of the deadliest battles in the entire war.
Well, you can picture being a young man and thousands of young people. They're going into a strange land. They got guns. They're going in to kill somebody they don't know. They think they're going to be killed any minute because bombs are coming. Bombs are going. And the boat going in toward Okinawa is slow, 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 going in to be killed, maybe. And it takes so long, it seems like 100 years.
A small, rocky, typhoon-swept island. This is Okinawa, principal link in the Ryukyu's chain, which stretches more than 340 miles over the vast western Pacific from Japan to Formosa. Unimportant? Perhaps at first glance. But Okinawa's role in today's tense world is far out of proportion to her size. In area equal to half that of Rhode Island, Okinawa is a vital outpost in the free world's defense network, less than 400 miles from the coast of communist China.
The Battle of Okinawa was the largest amphibious assault in the Pacific during World War II. The death toll was greater than both of the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. About 250,000 people died. That includes as many as 150,000 Okinawan civilians, more than 100,000 Japanese soldiers, and more than 12,000 Americans, including Mulligan. Our goal was obviously to invade mainland Japan, but in order to do so, we first had to take a number of Japanese-held islands. Military affairs expert Jeffrey Moore wrote about our battle strategy in that region in his book, Spies for Nimitz.
The main objective in taking all these islands on the drive toward Tokyo was to A, collect airfields, and B, collect anchorages, because we didn't have ships that could just go straight to Tokyo in one failed swoop. We didn't have planes that could just fly the whole way. We had to take these anchorages, these island bases along the way, and treat them basically like big giant military gas stations and big giant military Walmarts. We would put food and ammunition and planes on these things and hopscotch our way across the Pacific.
Okinawa, which was occupied by more than 100,000 Japanese soldiers, was an especially important Walmart stop. The Okinawans, a peaceful people colonized by Japan, were caught in the middle.
It was an imperialist move by the Japanese, and they never treated the Okinawans like Japanese, even after they made it as a prefecture. In fact, they called the Okinawans the little brown monkeys. It's so important to understand the Japanese did not really value them as people. They valued where they were.
Laura Holman Lacey is the author of Stay Off the Skyline, an oral history of the 6th Marine Division. She's also the U.S. representative for the Battle of Okinawa Museum.
The strategic value of Okinawa is that it's about 350 miles south of the furthest island in Japan. So for us, it was going to be the place where we could set up our planes as we got ready to invade mainland Japan. Okinawa is the first time that we are really on Japanese soil.
The first step? Bomb the hell out of the island. We called it Operation Iceberg. The Okinawans called it Tetsu no Ame, the Typhoon of Steel.
After the most tremendous naval and air pounding of the Pacific War, American troops landed on Okinawa.
It was Easter Sunday, 1945. It was also April Fool's Day. It marked the beginning of the most bitter island battle in modern history. The Japanese defense turned out to be desperate.
That morning, the men of Love Company were served a steak and eggs breakfast aboard the ship that brought them to Okinawa. Their commander, Major General Lemuel C. Shepard Jr., addressed them over a loudspeaker.
Officers and men of the 6th Marine Division, within the next few hours, our division will land on Japanese soil, the doorway to the enemy's country. It is an honor to be among the first to bring the war to the Japanese homeland. The 6th Marine Division is ready for the task to which it is assigned. During the past months of training, we have perfected our technique and forged our battle-seasoned regiments and battalions into a hard-hitting offensive team imbued with the will to win. When the day of battle comes, I have every confidence that you will strike with the force of a crusader, symbolized by the sword emblazoned on our shield, and bring victory and glory to our corps and country. I extend to each of you my sincere good wishes. May God in his infinite mercy bless our cause and protect us all.
My father, Mulligan, and all the others then climbed down rope nets into a landing craft to hit the beach. The U.S. Navy fired over their heads, pounding the shore with shells, each about as heavy as a Volkswagen Beetle.
And there's the largest armada in the history of mankind, modern mankind, 14,000 ships out there in that water. And, you know, the noise, the climbing down the ropes, planes flying over, the artillery barrages that have been going on for days, and then nothing.
Not a single Japanese soldier fired at them. The guys joked it was an April Fool's Day prank. Where were they?
We couldn't believe it. We were just like, we're still alive, you know. Walked right in. No shooting going on. All the other islands, you know, they met you right on the beach, man. They were right there waiting for you. So we expected the same thing on Okinawa. We expected to be met on the beach with a lot of gunfire. We didn't know if we'd even make it past the first day. The air was just full of gunite or smoke from the big cannons going off. A lot of naval gunfire, big battleships. And these little, like little donkeys come running down the hill and the guys were shooting at them. And the commander says, don't shoot at those, you know. But everybody was trigger happy, man. Anything that moved, you're going to shoot it, you know, before it shoots you.
For this particular operation, Okinawa, the Americans let loose 3,800 tons of naval artillery. It was the biggest naval preliminary bombardment of the war, and it fell on empty beaches.
Okinawa is a beautiful semi-tropical island. My dad often said if it wasn't a war going on, it would have been a great place for a vacation. It's about 70 miles long and 6 miles wide on average, and it's surrounded by deep blue waters and coral reefs. When Love Company first landed, a lot of the guys fished using hand grenades. They cooked the fish on a 55-gallon steel drum lid on the beach. It was eerily peaceful.
It used to be so hot when we went out on drills that the sun actually felt that it hung closer to the land. On one particular occasion, we were along a stream that came down from the mountain, and it was ice cold. And jumping from that situation of intense heat into this cold stream was the most beautiful feeling yet. It was just delicious, that cold water.
As the men passed fields of sugar cane and vegetables, Tom Price ached for a tomato. But he couldn't risk exposing himself to enemy fire in an open field.
I see all these ripe tomatoes out there. Oh, man, I'd love to have one of those. If I get out in that open field, man, you're asking for trouble. so I didn't eat a tomato. I just admired him from a distance.
Oh, that must have hurt.
As Love Company moved south, they soon became painfully aware that they were not alone on the island. American intelligence had completely misunderstood the Japanese battle plan and underestimated the number of enemy troops by 40,000. This operation was the biggest loss of life and ships from a single battle in our Navy's history. The men fought for 82 days on the island.
The Japanese weren't sure when the Americans were landing. They were pretty sure they were going to attack, but they didn't have the exact date. So about a month before the Americans landed, the Japanese high command took about 30,000 men off of the island. When you're trying to defend an island, that's a lot of folks. So the commander on Okinawa, Lieutenant General Ushijima, was forced to redesign his plan. So he pulled his troops off of certain landing beaches where they thought the Americans would land, and they pulled them into the interior southern part of the island and dug into caves, and they dug into trenches, and they hardened their fortifications, and they layered it all to the point that it was basically a big carpet that bristled with artillery and machine guns and mortars and all these different types of defenses, and they made it really, really tough for the Americans to take that island.
Okinawa's hills are filled with natural caves and ancestral tombs, and the Japanese dug an expansive maze of interconnected tunnels. All of this became a major part of their defense.
And where intelligence screwed up and where the commanders screwed up, the fighters, the army troops, and the Marines filled the gaps with their bravery and their lives. And they didn't have body armor those days. They had their dungarees, their cotton canvas shirts and helmets, and that's about it. Guys like your dad, with the satchel charge, with the bazooka, with the flamethrower, and with their guts, they made up the difference. And the butcher's bill was really high for that. They had to learn in the middle of combat about new Japanese defensive tactics. And I think that's one of the reasons that we indeed called them, you know, our greatest generation.
Well, you know, this becomes personal for me because my dad got his first blast concussions in the Battle of Sugarloaf Hill. And so did some of the guys. And so, frankly, it kind of pisses me off.
So what were you doing? Were you on the flank, just covering the flank?
We was in the front line. Nobody out there in front of us but Japs. Oh, that damned battalion of Japs coming up at us.
Just north of Naha,